Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome to Administrative Static. This is John Vecchione, and I want to get right into some big news that happened this week. Our youngest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, spoke at the Mitch McConnell Center at the University of Kentucky. And some of the press reports have said, oh, that's partisan, but it's a nonpartisan center that sort of grooms folks for higher level leadership in the University of Kentucky. So it's a nonpartisan. It just happens to be named after Mitch McConnell. And I don't doubt that's because of how much money he has directed there from his various perches in the federal government. But in any event, she went there and she spoke and she answered questions from the students, written questions. And the main soundbite you all might have heard already is that the Supreme Court is not comprised of partisan hacks. And I suppose she should have known that would be the headline. But what she was writing about there was that your judicial philosophies are not the same as partisanship. And in this, she's really echoing what Breyer, I've talked about Breyer talking about who spoke at Harvard and said, listen, don't pack the court. We're not acting as partisans. That was his message as well. And what's going on here is that there's a difference between Mitch McConnell, who's going to always be take the Republican side, even when it costs him. I think he's probably one of the most disliked politicians in the country because he's crossed Republicans of the Trump variety quite a bit. And he's obviously been a thorn in the side of the Democrats. And that means you don't have any, you don't always have a side. What Breyer and Barrett are talking about, and Barrett particularly, is that, look, they're not looking at what the political party or affiliation is of anyone before them or any issue before them. They're not looking through it at a Republican or Democratic lens, but obviously they do have judicial philosophies that differ quite a bit. And she talked about this and she said that we originalists, and she called herself an originalist, believe that all laws have to be interpreted the way they were understood at the time by the people who wrote them. Whereas the legal realists or progressives, depending on what you want to call them, believe that they have the power, the judges have the power to update the Constitution to our modern times because the Constitution's hard to amend. And so those two ideas, if you have those two ideas of judging, you're going to do different things. I'm obviously an originalist, but I understand oftentimes what the legal realists are doing. They just say, hey, this is we can't have this and we can't wait for the legislature. So they go ahead and do it. And the most active time for this and overturning stare decisis, and you're hearing now the great love of the legal realists for stare decisis, and that's because their heyday of the 1950s to the 1970s is now under retrenchment. I'll call it retrenchment because I don't think it's reversal. So Barrett answered all these questions, and I thought she didn't put a foot wrong in her answers and what she was saying. And I think it's very important for court watchers that, you know, Breyer is singing from the same hymn book as Justice Barrett, and that's the oldest and the youngest justice.
And I'm not sure about that metaphor, John.
Yeah, maybe you're right. But the thing is, everybody it's not without significance that everybody who is involved at a high level in the business of judging has come out against the press. And I was looking at one article, and I forget where it is. I'd like to give credit where credit's due. But I was looking at one article where they said that someone has done a study of what Supreme Court justices say about the press. And in the last 10 years, it's turned highly negative. The court does not say nice things about the press, whereas in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when they spoke, they'd always talk about the press as a bulwark of our liberties and doing important work in all of this.
In hushed tones,
exactly. And so the fact that, this also comes into play. I will say this. When I hear what they say about the press and how all it does is say what the result is for politics and doesn't tell anything about our reasoning. And both Breyer and Barrett have talked about this because, you know, they spend a lot of time writing opinions. It's not like they do their own work. You know, it's not like they just have staff go out and pop out an opinion. So I think they think that what the press is doing in regards to their opinion and the court's work, they're just critics straight out, Mark. You don't hear anything nice about the press, doing a great job of educating the public from these guys, I don't think.
Well, maybe if the press were doing a good job of educating the public, you would hear that occasionally from the court, but that's not what I've seen happening.
That's right.
I mean, just as one example, the way that the press has covered this this Texas abortion decision is it's just not accurate. They're treating it as though Roe v. Wade has been overturned because that's the talking points from the Planned Parenthood and groups like that on the left. But that's not what happened. This was a procedural, and you and I know this because we've been in plenty of cases where we've had some procedural thing go against us, and it's not on the merits. And so the idea that this is being portrayed the way it is, I think, is just indicative, maybe the latest and best example of what you're talking about how the media does not portray what the court does accurately.
Exactly. And I always, jurisdiction is so boring to every non-lawyer, and yet and it's not just the Supreme Court, all the appellate courts. District courts are a little more loosey-goosey about it, but, they pay deep attention to it. But the appellate courts and the Supreme Court, they care about all nine of them care more about jurisdiction than they do about any substantive issue, as far as I can tell. I mean,
Ginsburg was huge on jurisdiction.
Exactly. So this is an issue, jurisdiction, that appeals to no one outside of the law. And so many opinions and outcomes turn on that, on the issue of whether the case should be there. Instead of getting to the meat and potatoes that everyone wants them to get to, that the press will never, ever, ever really convey this. And I know the headline writers won't. That is really, like, I'm looking right here. The headline here is Barrett claims Supreme Court not comprised of partisan hacks. You know, they pulled that out. They pull out that soundbite and don't talk about the rest of it. So I think that I haven't really seen Barrett talking publicly since she was appointed in anything. Do you recall her doing anything else like this recently, Mark?
Not recently. I think she had given a talk at Hillsdale College shortly before she was confirmed, if I remember correctly, shortly before she was nominated, rather. And so I remember looking at that at the time of her nomination, and it was a nice long speech and kind of gave you a sense of her. But not since she's been on the court. No, I don't remember anything.
And Breyer, the term is their term is coming up. It'll be the first week in October, pretty soon. So first Monday in October, and so there will be soon there'll be a lot of cases to report, at least arguments and things like that. So that'll be good. But I do think that it was interesting, not only that she said that they weren't partisan, and she explained the difference in judicial philosophies. But she also said that the justices themselves have to be hyper vigilant to make sure they're not letting personal biases creep into their decision, since judges are people too. And because judges are people too is why the originalists don't think that the judges should be the ones making the laws and changing the Constitution. And she explained that. She said, listen, It's for the people to make the laws and change the Constitution and not us. And then the article I was reading then quoted Dan Rather, Scott Shapiro, and Sheldon Whitehouse for rebuttal, which is... yeah, exactly. Not exactly a nonpartisan, thoughtful lineup there. It's telling.
For those of our audience who don't know, Sheldon Whitehouse is the Democrat senator from Rhode Island.
And he's made up this list of there are 80-0 partisan 5-4 records, supporting big donors. Now, I'm not going to go through how erroneous that is on the
Not today, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to go through it, but it's made up stuff. And he is on a crusade. He thinks that the appointment of conservative or originalists to the bench, who are going to say what the law is and not what they want it to be, is some sort of constitutional crime. I mean, he's like,
right. You mean you're going to make us pass new laws instead of just pretending that we passed them before? That's so much harder.
Exactly. But, you know, this is one reason. She also talks about the collegiality on the court. And this is something that everyone really mentions. All of them talk about this. These folks, there are only 9 of them. And they got to meet in conference. And they're in the same building. And they served together for a very long time. So they do get to know each other well. And I haven't heard, of any feuds in this court. The Burger Court was known for people who hated each other. they were at it hammer and tong behind the scenes. I haven't heard any rumor about that here. Their disputes are out in the open. They're in their dissents and in their opinions. But I do think it's a hopeful sign that the judges, at least, are on the same page on how the court should act. We'll be back in a little bit.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. And John, I wanted to talk about a case in which the New Civil Liberties Alliance filed an amicus brief last week. This is a case at the U.S. Supreme Court on appeal from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The case name is American Hospital Association et al. v. Javier Becerra et al., Becerra being the Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Biden administration.
And I've also...
Yeah, go ahead.
I just that et al. Guy is so litigious.
Every case seems like, yeah, every major case he's in there. But the NCLA filed an amicus brief in this case. There are two issues presented to the Supreme Court in this case, and we're only focused on one of those issues. But one of the issues... And John, this goes back to what you were saying in the last segment. One of the issues goes to jurisdiction, and the parties did not ask the Supreme Court to reach this jurisdictional question. But the court granted cert, but then added a question, which feels a lot like a compromise verdict coming out of the conference. Added a question about whether the court has jurisdiction to hear the case. I think there's a statutory. So there's some statutory language suggesting that courts aren't supposed to weigh in on these Medicare pricing questions. And so whether or not the court even can weigh in is the other question. We didn't focus on that in our briefing. We focused instead on the question of Chevron deference because for those who haven't heard us rail against Chevron deference before, I will remind you that Chevron deference is the deference that administrative agencies get from federal judges in their interpretation of federal statutes. So here, there is a federal statute, Section 340B of the Drug Pricing Program, that dictates the way in which HHS can regulate the prices of where maybe not the prices, but regulate reimbursement for drugs under Medicare. And so it obviously matters a lot to hospitals who are getting reimbursed as to what these rates are. And from my time on Capitol Hill, I can tell you, John, that there are a few things on the Hill that are lobbied more heavily than Medicare reimbursement rates for different procedures. I mean, there are so many hospital associations, medical associations of one kind or another that are up there on Capitol Hill, and they are perennially complaining about the reimbursement rates under Medicare for different procedures. It's just it's a hardy perennial.
And it touches millions and millions of people, because what drugs they use and procedures they use and everything else that's available is affected by this across the country. So it is a big deal to regular people out there.
It is. And it might sound like I'm complaining about that lobbying. And in a sense, the amount of lobbying on Capitol Hill is astounding. On the other hand, if you want to know, are members of Congress really involved in the decision-making about what things get reimbursed and what things don't under Medicare? You betcha, they are involved, because that's one thing. There may be lots of decisions that are made in the bowels of the administrative state that the members of Congress have no idea about. And I'm sure that happens every day. But when it comes to something like this, particularly something that has a financial impact on hospitals or rural hospitals or hospitals in every congressman's district, perhaps literally every congressman's district in this case, that's something that they're going to hear about, they're going to know about, they're going to have been lobbied on it. And so the idea that the administrative agency might take a shortcut or might set up a pricing structure in a way different from the way that the statute did it and would get deference to that change this is one of those areas where, you know, I think that there was a lot of thought likely that went into whatever statute was passed here and whatever rule was set. Now, it may not be the case that members of Congress thoroughly debated that, but the relevant committees and the lobbyists who were involved certainly would have raised these issues at the legislative stage. And for it to get, for whatever compromise that was reached at the legislative stage to be undone at the administrative stage, even if undoing it is good policy, which it might be, I'm not taking a position on that. NCLA doesn't take a position on that in this brief. It's just a question, John, of who gets to make the law. Is it Congress or is it the administrative agency? And our view is that it should be the elected representatives of the people who get to make these decisions. And here the D.C. Circuit deferred to the judgment of the Health and Human Services Administration in changing the reimbursement rates and in reading the statutory language. And what the D.C. Circuit essentially said is that the interpretation that HHS came up with was reasonable, and therefore HHS was going to defer to that. But there was something
The judges were going to defer to it, Mark. The judges were going to defer to it.
The judges were going to defer to HHS's interpretation of the statute. That's right. If I missaid that, thanks for jumping in. But there was something that the D.C. Circuit did here that I don't think we've seen before, John. If you have seen it, let me know. But the D.C. Circuit, we already know, is as they bend over backwards more than any other court in the country in terms of giving Chevron deference to administrative agencies. A lot of administrative agency law goes through the D.C. Circuit, and they're just accustomed to bowing down to the agencies and giving them this Chevron deference. And this has been looked at empirically. This isn't just my opinion. The D.C. Circuit is more prone to deference than other circuits. But they took it even further, John, in this latest case. And what they said is, and this is a quote: when competing readings of a statute would each occasion their own notable superfluity, that manifests the kind of statutory ambiguity that Chevron permits the agency to weigh and resolve. So let me break that down. What they're saying is both the interpretation offered by HHS and the interpretation offered of the statute by the American Hospital Association had the effect of making some other statutory language in the statute superfluous, meaning that why would Congress have said that thing twice, or why would Congress have done things this way? It suggests that maybe your interpretation isn't the best interpretation. But there's a difference between the way that the American Hospital Association wanted to interpret it and the way that HHS interpreted it. And the way that HHS interpreted it took out an entire section of the statute and made it completely irrelevant. And the way that HHS interpreted it, it did make this one little piece superfluous, but really a relatively minor, you know, piece, and superfluous in the way of sort of belt and suspenders way of, well, why would Congress have said this here or meant this here if they already, you know, said it in this other part of the statute? But that's not something that's uncommon. We see that from time to time. And I'm not saying that it's never the case that kind of superfluousness might yield to a better interpretation, because sometimes it would. But what the D.C. Circuit essentially said here was, well, it doesn't matter that we have one kind of superfluousness that's minor and another kind of superfluousness that's major. As long as there's any amount of conflicting superfluousness, we'll see how many times I can say that word in today's broadcast. Anytime there's any amount of superfluousness on both sides, we're just going to permit the agency to weigh that and resolve it. And John, that's ridiculous.
Well, particularly because the canon of construction that you want to construe something without making any part of the statute superfluous is a judge-made canon. And the judges are in charge of this. One of the things why we hate Chevron deference is because it makes the tribunal unfair to the parties before it. The two parties are before it, and one party's getting deference on its view of the law, which is exactly what judges are there for. They're only there to interpret the law. That's their main job. And to put your thumb on the scale, even in an area where HHS is doing something that judges hate, which is, you know, making a part of the statute overrule it, or making it as if it didn't exist, that really ought to be in the hands of the court if it has to be done. So I had not heard that before.
Yeah, it's a new one on me, and it's particularly odd to see this happen after Kaiser. The Supreme Court had handed down the Kaiser decision a couple of years ago, 2019, I think, and what Kaiser had said is that before employing, in that case, it was our deference, which is deference to an agency's interpretation of its own regulations, which is different than Chevron deference to an agency's interpretation of statutes. But what the court said was, before you apply our deference, you have to go through all of the traditional tools of statutory construction. So you don't just get to apply one tool of statutory construction and say, ooh, this one VEC looks like it could go either way. I guess that's ambiguous. We'll just defer to the agency. No. That's not the way this works. You have to go through, it's the job of the judges, the job of the independent federal judiciary, which the Constitution went through a lot of pain and effort to make independent, and gave it all sort buttressed its independence with all sorts of features that we've walked through on this program before. And the job of those independent judges to assess the best interpretation of the statute, not to throw up its hands at the first sign of trouble and defer to the agency. But that's what happened here. So, you know, I think, and as John said, I mean, this is an example of a case that has major ramifications for ordinary folks in terms of whether, look, some hospitals would probably close down if HHS is able to lower reimbursement rates the way that it wants to. Some rural hospitals or some hospitals that do a lot of procedures that are affected by this reimbursement rate are going to close down. And that's where you get Congress's attention. No congressman wants to lose a hospital in their district. But the idea that the D.C. Circuit would just defer to HHS when it hasn't walked through all of the statutory interpretation steps is something new and different. And I think if the Supreme Court hears this case, it's going to say, no, that's not the way that works. So we'll see what happens. You know, we obviously would love to see Chevron struck down altogether. But I think if the court reaches this case and decides that it has jurisdiction, it's going to at least get rid of this superfluidity analysis. We'll be right back.